Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for October 11, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. The headline article on the first page reads, Biden, Americans among Hamas hostages. Palestinians scramble for safety. Blinken to visit Israel. President Joe Biden on Tuesday confirmed that U.S. citizens are among the hostages captured by Hamas as he condemned the militant group for the sheer evil of its shocking weekend assault on Israel. Our hearts may be broken, but our resolve is clear, said Biden, who compared the brutality of the Hamas militants to that of the Islamic State terrorist group. Let there be no doubt, the United States has Israel's back, he said. We'll make sure the Jewish and Democratic State of Israel can defend itself today, tomorrow, as we always have. The president coupled his defense for Israel with only a glancing reference to the suffering that innocent Palestinians are enduring from Israel's barrage of retaliatory fire on the Gaza Strip, where the Hamas attack was launched. That approach could prove more difficult to sustain going forward if, as expected, the humanitarian crisis for the Palestinians worsens as Israel expands its military operation to root out Hamas. Biden took note of the impact on Americans as well. He said the number of U.S. citizens confirmed to have been killed in the fighting reached 14, up from 11 reported previously. U.S. officials said that death toll could increase further as some 20 Americans remain unaccounted for. There's no justification for terrorism. There's no excuse, Biden said. Hamas does not stand for the Palestinian people's right to dignity and self-determination. Their stated purpose is the annihilation of the State of Israel and the murder of Jewish people. They use Palestinian citizens as human shields. Hamas responded to Biden's remarks with a statement defending its actions, saying they were fighting against an occupation and defending Palestinians' right to self-determination. Hamas called on Biden to move away from the policy of double standards when it comes to Israel. Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke by phone earlier Tuesday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Biden outlined the actions he and other allies took to support Israel in the aftermath of the attack and expressed his horror about sickening reports of torture inflicted by militants on civilians. Retaliatory strikes by Israel on the Gaza Strip have also left hundreds of dead and wounded Palestinians in the blockaded 141 square mile area, one of the poorest places in the world. The death toll was expected to grow as Israel pummeled Gaza with airstrikes and sent tens of thousands of Palestinians fleeing into UN shelters. Biden said he directed his team to share intelligence and military experts to consult and advise Israelis. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said Secretary of State Antony Blinken will travel to Israel in the coming days to deliver a message of solidarity and support. He said Blinken also will talk about what additional resources we can give them. Blinken will leave Wednesday and is expected to arrive on Thursday. Israeli warplanes hammered the Gaza Strip neighborhood by neighborhood Tuesday, reducing buildings to rubble and sending people scrambling to find safety in the tiny, sealed-off territory. Humanitarian groups pleaded for the creation of corridors to get aid into Gaza and warned that hospitals overwhelmed with wounded people were running out of supplies. Israel stopped entry of food, fuel, and medicines into Gaza, and the sole remaining access from Egypt shut down Tuesday after airstrikes hit near the border crossing. The war, which claimed at least 1,900 lives, is expected to escalate. The weekend attack that Hamas said was retribution for worsening conditions for Palestinians under Israeli occupation cemented Israel's determination to crush the group's hold in Gaza. New exchanges of fire over Israel's northern borders with militants in Lebanon and Syria on Tuesday pointed to the risk of an expanded regional conflict. Hamas militants stormed into Israel on Saturday morning, slaying hundreds of residents in homes and streets near the Gaza border and bringing gun battles to Israeli towns for the first time in decades. Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza hold about 150 soldiers and civilians hostage, according to Israel. Israel stepped up its offensive on Tuesday, expanding the mobilization of reservists to 360,000. Israel's military said it regained effective control over areas Hamas attacked in its south and of the Gaza border. Rescue officials in Gaza said large numbers of people were trapped under the remnants of leveled buildings, with rescue equipment and ambulances unable to reach the area. On Tuesday, a large part of Gaza City's Ramal neighborhood was reduced to rubble after airstrikes the night before. The Israeli military said it struck hundreds of targets in Ramal, an upscale district home to ministries of the Hamas-run government, universities, media organizations, and aid agency offices. In a new tactic, Israel is warning civilians to evacuate neighborhood after neighborhood, then inflicting devastation in what could be a prelude to a ground offensive. On Tuesday, the military told residents of the nearby Al-Daraj neighborhood to evacuate, and soon after, new explosions rocked it and other areas, continuing into the night. In all, dozens of fighter jets hit more than 70 targets in the area, according to Israeli military officials, who said Hamas directed attacks against Israel from the neighborhood. One blast hit Gaza City's seaport, setting fishing boats aflame. There is no safe place in Gaza right now. You see decent people being killed every day, Hassan Jabbar, a Gaza journalist, said after three Palestinian journalists were killed in the Ramal bombardment. I am genuinely afraid for my life. Tuesday afternoon, Hamas fired barrages of rockets toward the southern Israeli city of Ashkelon and Tel Aviv. There were no immediate reports of casualties. On Tuesday night, a group of militants entered an industrial zone in Ashkelon, sparking a gun battle with Israeli troops, the military said. Three militants were killed, and troops searched the area for others. Also on the front page, an article entitled "Harvest is Progressing and the Weather is Fine." Western Iowa was the recipient of above-average precipitation last week. However, the state still has 5.9 days suitable for fieldwork during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Corn and soybean harvest continued to be the primary field activities for the week. Harvest is in full swing. Warmer temperatures and mostly dry conditions across the state allowed for significant harvest progress in the past week, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig. Forecasts are highlighting the chances of widespread rainfall statewide this week, potentially keeping combines out of the fields for a few days later this week. Topsoil moisture conditions rated 32% very short, 44% short, 23% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture condition rated 37% very short, 43% short, 19% adequate, and 1% surplus. Corn maturity reached 96% this week, 8 days ahead of last year, and 11 days ahead of the 5-year average. Corn harvested for grain reached 30% statewide, 5 days ahead of last year, and 6 days ahead of the average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain was at 19%. Corn condition declined slightly to 48% good to excellent. Soybeans dropping leaves was 94% this week, 3 days ahead of last year and 5 days ahead of the average. Soybeans harvested reached 52%, 1 day ahead of last year and 1 week ahead of the average, as Iowa farmers were able to harvest 28% of the state's soybeans during the week ending Sunday. Soybean conditions rated 48% good to excellent. Pasture condition rated 16% good to excellent. Livestock conditions were reported as generally good, but some producers continued to haul hay and water to their livestock on pasture. The first week of October remained unseasonably warm, though temperatures took a nosedive toward the end of the reporting period. The statewide average temperature was 60.3 degrees, 5.7 degrees above normal. Western Iowa received above-average rainfall totals with unseasonably dry conditions, continuing across Iowa's eastern two-thirds, according to Justin Gleason, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Weekly precipitation totals ranged from a trace at several stations to 1.85 inches in Little Sioux, Harrison County. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 0.34 inches, while the normal is 0.65 inches. Spencer Municipal Airport in Clay County reported the week's high temperature of 95 degrees on the 1st, 25 degrees above normal. Sibley in Osceola County reported the week's low temperature of 29 degrees on the 8th, 10 degrees below normal. And finally, on the front page, a third article entitled Iowa Flags at Half Staff to Honor Slain Israelis. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, who has worked to strengthen ties between Iowa and Israel in recent years, ordered flags at half staff in Iowa on Monday to honor the lives lost in the deadly attack in Israel by Hamas militants over the weekend. Iowa mourns for the families of those killed by Hamas in Israel. Hamas brutality knows no bounds, with reports of Holocaust survivors, women and children taken by Hamas militants from their homes as hostages or brutally murdered, Reynolds said in a statement Monday. Today and every day, Iowa stands in solidarity with Israel and their right to defend themselves. The conflict in Israel and Gaza unfolded after the Palestinian militant group Hamas launched an unprecedented surprise attack on Israel on Saturday. Israel has responded with rocket strikes in the blockaded Gaza Strip. More than 1,300 people had been killed as of Monday, including at least 9 Americans, according to reports. Flags will be flown at half staff on public buildings, and businesses and individuals are encouraged to fly flags at half staff until October 15. Reynolds has worked to nurture Iowa's relationship with Israel, dating back to before her time as governor. In 2016, she joined a Republican Lieutenant Governors Association delegation to the country with her counterparts from Texas, Florida, and other states. Then in 2017, after assuming the role of governor, Reynolds led a trade mission to Israel to develop business opportunities for Israeli companies in Iowa. Reynolds went on another international trade mission in June of this year that included a visit to Israel and a discussion with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In a statement at the time, Reynolds' office said she and Netanyahu discussed strengthening economic ties. Reynolds went on another international trade mission in June of this year, and that's a repeat of the paragraph that I just read. Reynolds signed a proclamation of support for Israel on the 75th anniversary of its establishment as an independent nation and participated in a wreath-laying ceremony at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center in Jerusalem. She also met with Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Strategic Affairs, her office said. Shortly after Reynolds' visit this year, 7 Israeli agriculture startups participated in a program through America's Cultivation Corridor, sponsored by the Iowa Economic Development Authority, to prepare them to enter the American market. This course, led by food and ag industry and research leadership, is a great opportunity to establish the right connections for businesses to scale into the U.S. system, Reynolds said in August, From my recent travels to Israel, it is great to see the continuation of our conversations through programs like this, and we look forward to companies continuing to build their connections here. Reynolds and Iowa lawmakers have also strengthened Iowa's rejection of companies that boycott Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories. In 2022, lawmakers extended a previously existing law barring the state from investing in companies that boycott Israel and take part in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. The original investment ban was signed in 2016 by then-Governor Terry Branstad, as several other states around the nation were enacting similar laws. In 2022, the 2022 law changed the wording to also ban state investments in wholly owned subsidiaries that boycott Israel. The legislation was seen by Democrats as specifically targeting the Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream Company, a subsidiary of Unilever. Lawmakers paired that with a bill that defined anti-Semitism in Iowa law and encouraged the state to consider anti-Semitism when investigating a discriminatory act. Today, we express Iowa's enduring support for the State of Israel and our categorical rejection of anti-Semitism, Reynolds said in a press release when she signed both bills into law. Together, these bills send an important message. Iowa continues to stand shoulder to shoulder with the State of Israel, one of America's most important and reliable allies, while fighting all forms of religious and ethnic discrimination. On page 2, we have another article regarding the Israelis. The article is entitled, "Many Israelis Feel Abandoned Amid the Chaos." It was, they thought, an ironclad social contract. Israeli citizens would serve in the military and live along enemy borders. In exchange, the army would defend them. That contract was shattered on Saturday when hundreds of Hamas militants breached Israel's defenses from the Gaza Strip, pouring in by air, land, and sea on a rampage that would leave hundreds dead. The infiltration caught Israel's storied high-tech army completely unaware and stunned a country that prides itself on military prowess. Further shocking Israelis was how long it took the military to respond, as thousands in southern Israel suddenly found themselves besieged. Their cries for help went unanswered for hours, holed up inside homes and safe rooms as militants sprayed bullets, torched homes, and hurled grenades. They turned in desperation to social media, to journalists, and to friends, beseeching the army to save them. The weekend attack and the military's response brought an unsettling new sense of vulnerability and abandonment. Thousands of families had no idea whether loved ones were alive or had been taken as captives to Gaza. At the height of the violence, there was no one to turn to for guidance or information. Contact centers were eventually set up, but the focus was on soliciting information from families rather than offering it. Six members of Jonathan Silver's family are missing, and he approached authorities for help. At least three relatives are captive in Gaza, he said, and the others are assumed to be there too. He saw a video of a cousin and two children taken hostage from their kibbutz near Oz. But the family has received no information, Silver said. We tried to reach everybody, the Homeland Command, police, friends, acquaintances, people on the kibbutz, he said, and for hours there was no one to talk to. He's particularly concerned for his aunt, who has Parkinson's disease and needs her medication. He's frustrated, but he also said now is not the time to criticize too deeply. I have a lot of questions and a lot to say. The day of reckoning will come, he said. But now I prefer to stand beside the army. In Israel, military service is compulsory for most Jewish men and women. In the eyes of many citizens, it is the glue that keeps the country together in a region widely hostile to its presence, and is recognized worldwide for its technological advances and intelligence-gathering capabilities. That it could be taken so completely by surprise by a militant group is something Israelis are hard-pressed to fathom. For Merav Lashem Gonen, a feeling of helplessness gripped her when her daughter called in a panic from a music festival that was attacked. "Mommy, we were bombed. They shot at us. The car was shot. We cannot drive. Everybody here is hurt," Gonen recounted her daughter saying. "She was talking to me and said, 'Mommy, help us. We don't know what to do.' And I'm saying, 'We love you and it's okay. We are trying to find a way to take you out of there. We are sending people.'" Gonen told a news conference outside Tel Aviv, "And I know I'm lying because we don't have answers. And we didn't have any answers then. Nobody had." Journalist Amir Toubon had great fortune that many others didn't. While the army struggled to regroup, his 62-year-old father, a retired general, entered the breach. Noam Toubon headed from his home in Tel Aviv to Nahal Oz, a kibbutz, where his son, his wife, and their two young daughters were hunkering in a safe room. On the way, he connected with another retired general and a group of commandos. After firefights with militants along the way, the elder Toubon extricated his son and family. More than a dozen others at Nahal Oz did not survive. "The terms of the contract between us and the state had always been clear. We protect the border, and the state protects us," Amir Toubon wrote in an article retelling the rescue for his newspaper, Haaretz. "We fulfilled our share of the deal heroically. For all too many of our beloved friends and neighbors on this black day of Saturday, October 7, the State of Israel did not fulfill its share." Mayan Zinn said she learned that her two daughters had been abducted when a relative sent her photos from a Telegram group appearing to show them sitting on mattresses in captivity. She's among dozens of distraught families who say there's been a lack of support from Israeli authorities about their loved ones held in Gaza. "There is no information. No one has contacted me since yesterday, not the army, not the government, not the police," she said. At first, she couldn't believe what she saw in the images. "I thought it was photoshopped," she said. And now in other national and world news, we have an article entitled, "Document Shows Property Size. Prosecutors, evidence suggests Trump faked value of his penthouse." Donald Trump signed a document 30 years ago that gave the true size of his New York penthouse that was listed as far larger on later financial statements, according to evidence Tuesday at the former president's civil business fraud trial. The evidence appeared in an email attachment shown as Alan Weisselberg, the former finance chief of Trump's company, testified in New York Attorney General Letitia James' fraud lawsuit against Trump and his Trump Organization. Trump denies wrongdoing. The attachment was a 1994 document signed by Trump that pegged his Trump Tower triplex at 10,996 square feet, not the 30,000 square feet he later claimed for years on financial statements that were given to banks, insurers, and others to make deals and secure loans. Weisselberg said he recalled seeing the email but not the attachment, explaining the attachments were documents he already had on file in the company's offices. In any event, he said he didn't pay much mind to the apartment size because its value amounted to a fraction of Trump's wealth. "I never even thought about the apartment. It was de minimis in my mind," Weisselberg said, using a Latin term that means essentially too small to care about. "It was not something that was that important to me when looking at a $5 billion net worth," said Weisselberg, who will return to the witness stand on Wednesday. Later, Weisselberg was asked about an appraisal that came in $230 million below what Trump's financial statement showed for his Seven Springs estate north of New York City. Weisselberg said he was aware of the appraisal, but didn't think the disparity was worth flagging to the outside accountants who prepared the statements. Nevertheless, Weisselberg acknowledged signing documents certifying that financial summaries given to banks to meet loan requirements were true, correct, and completely and fairly represented Trump's financial condition. Weisselberg said he couldn't remember whether he discussed the financial statements with Trump while they were being finalized. The ex-CFO said he reviewed drafts from a 30,000-foot level, but paid special attention to something very, very important to Trump, the descriptions of his properties. Weisselberg said he learned of the Trump Tower penthouse size discrepancy only when a Forbes magazine reporter pointed it out to him in 2016. He testified that he initially disputed the magazine's findings, but said he couldn't recall whether he directed anyone to look into the matter. And now a story from the United Nations. Russia was defeated in its bid to regain a seat in the UN's premier human rights body by a significant majority in Tuesday's election in the General Assembly, which voted last year to suspend Moscow after its invasion of Ukraine. Russia competed against Albania and Bulgaria for two seats on the Geneva-based Human Rights Council, representing the East European Regional Group. In the secret ballot vote, Bulgaria got 160 votes, Albania received 123 votes, and Russia just 83 votes. Russia claims it has support from a silent majority, and even though 83 votes came from less than half of the 193 UN member nations, there is certain to be a concern, especially from Ukraine and its Western allies, that Moscow's support was that high. The United States and others sent letters to many of the 193 members of the General Assembly urging a vote against Russia, according to diplomats. Felice Geyer, director of the American Jewish Committee Jacobs Blostein Institute for the Advancement of Human Rights, was among the non-government letter writers also urging Russia's defeat. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met with his counterpart in Romania on Tuesday for talks on regional security and to strengthen bilateral ties against the backdrop of Russia's invasion. He described the partnership between the two countries as key to stability for Europe and beyond. On the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, after meeting with President Klaus Iohannis in the capital, Bucharest. The two discussed security in the Black Sea region, economic cooperation, shared infrastructure projects, and Ukraine's requests for military support, Zelensky said after the meetings. He also thanked Romania for providing both military and humanitarian support for his war-torn country. Earlier on Tuesday, the Ukrainian president described the NATO and European Union member country as, quote, a friend who came to our help on our darkest day and whose support gets stronger with time, on X. In recent weeks, Russia has carried out sustained attacks on Ukraine's Danube River ports, located just across the river from Romania, as Moscow aims to disrupt Ukraine's ability to export grain to world markets. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for October 11, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for October 11, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the headline story is entitled Farm Rescue Touches Down at Clarion. Wright County Farmer Battles Health Concerns While Farm Rescue Comes to Help. Piloting a 747 over the Pacific Ocean may be about as far away from a Wright County farm as one can get on this planet, but it gave Captain Bill Gross time to think about what he'd like to do in retirement. A North Dakota farm kid, Gross may have left the farm for his career, but farming never left his heart. As they were flying high above the ocean, far removed from the farms and ranches he knew as a child, Gross told his co-pilot that one day he wanted to retire, buy some equipment, and help farmers in need. His co-pilot had a challenge. Why wait? Gross didn't wait and founded Farm Rescue, a nonprofit organization that travels much of America's heartland providing critical help to farmers facing serious health issues. Grant and Nicole Woodley never imagined they would be the beneficiaries of such a high-flying dream of helping farmers in need. But as September faded to October, it was Farm Rescue that pulled into the couple's Clinton area farm to harvest some 425 acres of soybeans. "I am absolutely so grateful," Grant Woodley said. "It helped me so much. It even helped my neighbors because I know they would have been wanting to help and they needed to do their own beans." Farm Rescue brought in one combine and one grain truck, along with volunteers to operate the machinery. That, combined with Woodley's own grain cart and two more trucks, were enough to finish the job in a timely fashion. They brought in a guy from John Deere in Ankeny to operate the combine, and he told me he was glad to get out of the office and into a cab. Derek Nord is the John Deere representative who helped on this farm rescue operation. He is just one of a number of current and retired John Deere employees who have signed on to volunteer, according to Dan Erdman, marketing manager for Farm Rescue. Keith Barkema, a Farm Rescue volunteer from Clemmy, came to drive the trucks. The two trucks came from Woodley and a neighbor with whom he shares work each season on a handshake agreement. The timing was perfect as central Iowa had been experiencing record high temperatures and soybeans needed to come out of the fields promptly. The combination of high heat followed by very strong winds was drying the beans down rapidly. "This year was really unique," Woodley said. "I've never seen a year quite like it. The beans went from 14% to 8% in a matter of hours, so it was just really critical that everybody get their beans out ASAP. Woodley said he was very impressed with the professionalism of Farm Rescue and how efficient the group was in getting the work done, from juggling schedules and getting the right equipment in place at the right time with the right people to get the job done was simply amazing to watch. They don't move equipment just from one end of the county to the other. They move it from one state to the next," Woodley said. "They work hard, and I was just really impressed and grateful to the people involved in making it happen." Farm Rescue also got some help from Iowa Corn and First Citizens Bank, which delivered meals to the men on the move. Dahl Distributing of Des Moines also contributed food, beverages, and apparel items at a post-harvest celebration. Having the soybean harvest done removed a big worry for Woodley and his family. He and his wife, Nicole, have five children, all teenagers. In addition to farming, they are both ordained ministers in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Because Farm Rescue helps with just one operation per family per year, Woodley is still working on a plan for his corn harvest, but for now is grateful beyond words to have the beans done. But how did this Wright County farmer, who as a youth earned his American FFA degree renting land as a 19-year-old, get to the point of needing a rescue? Woodley's journey began in March when he started experiencing seizure-like episodes. He was eventually diagnosed with brain abscesses and went through multiple neurosurgeries. "I went to the University of Iowa for my treatment, and their job was to keep me from dying," Woodley said, matter-of-factly. With that goal of saving his life accomplished, Woodley had to get on with life, and in July went to Ankeny, where the name of the facility, On With Life, describes perfectly the mission that teams of therapists set for Woodley. "They told me their name is not an accident," he recalled. "We want to know what you want out of life, and we're going to set goals to help you get there." Woodley hopes to return to farming full-time. He continues to receive physical, occupational, and speech therapy to make that goal a reality. "My endurance is coming back, but they taught me to live life 45 minutes at a time," Woodley said. "I can do anything for 45 minutes, and then I have to do something else, alternate. The old me would have been working 15 hours a day at harvest. Now there's just no way. But Woodley is encouraged by his progress and devoted to the homework that On With Life has assigned him. "I've been doing my homework," he said, of the physical and other therapy skills they have taught him to practice. Shortly after Woodley began having seizures, his wife Nicole found a lump. She had breast cancer some 10 years ago, but this was not a recurrence of breast cancer, but a very rare sarcoma that resulted from the radiation treatments originally used to treat the first cancer. Nicole underwent her own series of surgeries and treatments, first in Des Moines and then at MD Anderson in Texas. She battled infection and progressed to a life-threatening sepsis before recovering. Today, her prognosis is good, but the risk of the cancer returning means the couple must be extremely vigilant. It's an aggressive cancer, and it can come back quickly and grow quickly. So she goes back to Texas every 3 months for scans, Woodley said. 1 year ago, the family could not have imagined how different this harvest would be, but with the help from Farm Rescue, they are a big step closer to wrapping up another harvest. The corn remains to be done, but Woodley trusts that living 45 minutes at a time will see him through whatever comes next. Founded in 2005, Farm Rescue has provided assistance to more than 1,000 farm and ranch families in Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Kansas, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana. The organization will help plant, harvest, hay, feed, and even haul. Applications for assistance, as well as a history of the program, even how to volunteer, can be found on the group's website at farmrescue.org. Also on the front page, an article entitled "Supervisors OK Easement Agreement for Badger Trail." From Clare, the Webster County Board of Supervisors approved an agreement on Tuesday with a pair of landowners for a permanent easement on a little over 10 acres of their property for the construction of a recreational trail between Badger and Fort Dodge. The board held its meeting, quote, on the road, close quote, this week at the Clare Community Center. During the meeting, the board unanimously approved the agreement to pay $85,000 to Dennis and Brenda Plain for a permanent easement on 10.6 acres of their property north of Fort Dodge near 170th Street and Paragon Avenue. The acquisition of the easement is part of Webster County Conservation's 4.7-mile paved recreational trail connection project along Paragon Avenue between Badger and Fort Dodge. The project has been in the works for the last 3 years. The county has or will enter permanent easement agreements with several landowners along the trail's route. The trail connection project is one of several outdoor recreation and quality of life projects Webster County Conservation has undertaken in the last few years. Other projects include the new River's Edge Discovery Center, currently being constructed along the Des Moines River west of downtown Fort Dodge, as well as the recently completed improvements at Badger Lake. On Saturday, Webster County Conservation is hosting a grand opening for the Badger Lake Trail at John F. Kennedy Memorial Park from 4 to 8 p.m. The 1.4-mile trail that encircles Badger Lake is now paved and more accessible to more trail users. The next regular meeting of the Webster County Board of Supervisors will be 10 a.m. on October 24 at the Badger Community Center, while the board's regular meeting room at the Webster County Courthouse is closed for HVAC construction. The board will be taking its meetings on the road for the next 2 months. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled "Rising Values May Lead to Appeals. State Imposed 14% Increase." After owners of Webster County commercial properties learn their assessed values are potentially rising by 14%, County Assessor Angie Vinson won't be surprised if people file appeals by the October 31 deadline. Some Webster County commercial owners are displeased with the rising assessment, in part because they could lead to higher property taxes. Vincent herself isn't very happy with the state's recent equalization order, which put in place even higher assessments than Vincent's office thought was necessary. "I am still upset about it. I am not going to lie," she said. Even more surprising was the process that led to the 14% increase order from the Iowa Department of Revenue. Every odd-numbered year, Iowa counties must update the assessed valuation of all classifications of property. The goal is to link county assessments so that they are equal to the trend of recent sales market values. Vincent said her team in the assessor's office concertedly work to get the values at the right amount. The Iowa Department of Revenue overviews all counties as a second set of eyes on the valuations. "We try to do it well in-house, so we don't get this," she said. The last time the Iowa Department of Revenue issued an equalization order on Webster County commercial assessments came in 2015, after the state looked at the initial Webster County commercial property assessments. It said in July that values should be set with a 12% increase. Vincent challenged that as too high. The state responded in late September with a surprise. Not only did the Department of Revenue not agree, it said the hike should move from 12 to 14%. "We weren't the only county. We weren't the highest county," Vincent said. "Other counties got it too, some for commercial properties, some for residential properties." The fact that other Iowa counties are also having higher assessed values isn't making the reality to go down easier in Webster County. Commentary seen on social media in recent days showed some people complaining about the higher commercial assessments. The higher assessments have the potential to lead to higher property taxes, depending upon what county supervisors, city councils, and school boards do next spring when setting fiscal year 2024-2025 budgets. Property taxes are determined by two factors: the assessed valuations and the property tax rates set by those three taxing bodies. If the tax levies don't decrease next year, the property taxes could go up, depending upon what happens with the so-called rollback percentage, which determines how much of a property's value is taxable. All this comes on the heels of the spring 2023 months, when another category of valuation assessments, residential home assessments, also got big hikes, including up to 45%. Vincent said her team did the best it could, but it was difficult to set commercial property values since only 30 such properties sold in the county in 2020. "Before, values were stagnant, but now they're going up," Vincent said, referencing increased sales prices that followed the national housing trend of inflation. Letters went out the first week of October to Webster County property owners explaining their option to appeal valuations by October 31. Property owners will need to have statistical evidence to support their argument that their assessed valuation should be lowered. Those appeals would be decided by a special session of the Board of Review. And now the Messenger editorial, entitled "Thursday is National Farmers' Day. It's a good time to remember agriculture's contributions." Thursday has been designated as National Farmers' Day. It's the contemporary event to honor the hard work of America's farmers and to reflect on their important contribution to not only the success of our nation, but to helping feed the world far beyond America's borders. The commemoration grew out of an event that began long ago called Old Farmers' Day. That observance began at a time when many more Americans were directly working in agriculture. The selection of October 12 for National Farmers' Day is a reflection that by then the annual harvest is done or nearly done. With a growing season at an end, it's a good time to recognize the contribution agriculture makes in the lives of all of us. While it seems unlikely that many Iowans need to be reminded that agriculture is vital to this state, this is a good time to recall just how impressive American agriculture truly has become. Today, just 2% of the American population grows and produces the food for the remaining 98% of the population. According to the Agriculture Council of America, each of this country's farmers feeds more than 144 people, up from 25 people just four decades ago. That's very good news for Americans, but also for hungry people everywhere. This country produces far more agricultural products than Americans can consume. The resulting exports help offset trade deficits in other areas of the economy. In fact, agricultural products are this country's number one export. One in three U.S. farm acres is planted for export. The agricultural sector in the United States has become incredibly efficient at producing a wide array of products. Americans spend less on food than people in any other developed nation. The ACA says we Americans spend only 2% of our disposable income on meat and poultry. As recently as 1970, it was 4.1%. At the heart of this productive agricultural sector are the farmers, the folks who get up before dawn to do chores in the barn and spend long hours behind the wheel of a tractor or combine. They are the humble heroes who make it possible for the rest of us to have good things to eat. We salute them for their tireless efforts. An article now entitled Stumpies in Duncombe faces potential ouster just as it lands a top five slot in tenderloin contest. Bruce Wagner said Tuesday that it's true. The American Legion post in Duncombe is trying to oust him and his business from its home in this tiny Webster County town. His business is Stumpy's Bar and Grill, which right now is one of the five finalists in the quest to name Iowa's top pork tenderloin sandwich. The place is named after Wagner, who more commonly goes by Stumpy because he is short. He said the reason he's being ousted is not because of money. His rent is $500, he said. His business, which he started 10 years ago in the old building at 423 Main Street, is an active business. Right now, he's swamped with farmers feeding the people harvesting crops in a race to beat the rain. It's not business, Wagner said Tuesday, it's personal. His daughter, Emily Wagner, who works at the place every other Saturday, said in a letter that her father needed help to keep his business ongoing in Duncombe. She wrote, Stumpy's, well-known bar and grill in Duncombe, made its first debut 10 years ago. Since then, Bruce Wagner, a.k.a. Stumpy, has always given back to the community by bringing in patrons from all over, providing employment opportunity in a small town, and offering up the establishment for numerous benefits. Not only does Stumpy's have great customer service and ice-cold drinks, but it put Duncombe on the map when it was voted as one of the top five best tenderloins in Iowa. It has come to the attention of the community that Legion Post 491 is arduously attempting to terminate the lease without cause, but stating for personal reasons against the owner, brought by two of the Legion members. Other members voted against the decision to eradicate Stumpy's. Many of the locals have vehemently voiced outrages at the duplicitous actions of Legion Post 491, even going as far as petitioning 200-plus signatures to keep the establishment in the community. We would be remiss to say that this is anything other than a bias-based decision. Our efforts to keep Stumpy's going are only as effective as the number of people we can reach with this information. Closing a successful business without cause is never advantageous to anyone. The whole town is in an uproar, Stumpy Wagner said. They have no plans, Stumpy Wagner added. It will be an empty building. I don't own the building, the exhaust fan, and the furnaces. All the rest of the equipment is mine. In international news, we have an article entitled "Palestinians Scramble for Safety as Israel Pounds Sealed Off Gaza Strip." Israeli warplanes hammered the Gaza Strip on neighborhood by neighborhood Tuesday, reducing buildings to rubble and sending people scrambling to find safety in the tiny sealed-off territory, now suffering severe retaliation for the deadly weekend attack by Hamas militants. Humanitarian groups pleaded for the creation of corridors to give aid into Gaza and warned that hospitals overwhelmed with wounded people were running out of supplies. Israel has stopped every entry of food, fuel, and medicines into Gaza, and the sole remaining access from Egypt shut down Tuesday after airstrikes hit near the border crossing. The war, which has claimed at least 1,900 lives on both sides, is expected to escalate. The weekend attack that Hamas said was retribution for worsening conditions for Palestinians under Israeli occupation has inflamed Israel's determination to crush the group's hold in Gaza. New exchanges of fire over Israel's northern border with militants in Lebanon and Syria on Tuesday pointed to the risk of an expanded regional conflict. Hamas militants stormed into Israel on Saturday morning, slaying hundreds of residents in homes and streets near the Gaza border, and bringing gun battles to Israeli towns for the first time in decades. Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza hold about 150 soldiers and civilians hostage, according to Israel. Israel stepped up its offensive on Tuesday, expanding the mobilization of reservists to 360,000. Israel's military said it had regained effective control over areas Hamas attacked in its south and the Gaza border. A looming question is whether Israel will launch a ground assault into Gaza, a 25-mile strip of land wedged among Israel, Egypt, and the Mediterranean Sea that is home to 2.3 million people and has been governed by Hamas since 2007. Rescue officials in Gaza said large numbers of people were still trapped under the remnants of leveled buildings, with rescue equipment and ambulances unable to reach the area. On Tuesday, a large part of Gaza City's Rimal neighborhood was reduced to rubble after hours of airstrikes the night before. Residents found buildings torn in half or demolished to mounds of concrete and rebar. Cars were flattened and trees burned out on residential streets, transformed into moonscapes. Palestinian Civil Defense Forces pulled Abdullah Musle out of his basement together with 30 others after their apartment building was flattened. "I sell toys, not missiles," the 46-year-old said, weeping. "I want to leave Gaza. Why do I have to stay here? I lost my home and my job." The Israeli military said it struck hundreds of targets in Rimal, an upscale district home to ministries of the Hamas-run government, universities, media organizations, and the aid agency offices. In a new tactic, Israel is warning civilians to evacuate neighborhood after neighborhood and then inflicting devastation in what could be a prelude to a ground offensive. On Tuesday, the military told residents of the nearby Al-Daraj neighborhood to evacuate. New explosions soon rocked it and other areas, continuing into the night. In all, dozens of fighter jets hit more than 70 targets in the area, according to Israeli military officials, who said Hamas had directed attacks against Israel from the neighborhood. A little bit on the weather. Article entitled "Ring of Fire Solar Eclipse Will Slice Across the Americas on Saturday." Tens of millions in the Americas will have front row seats for Saturday's rare Ring of Fire eclipse of the sun. What's called an annular solar eclipse, better known as a ring of fire, will briefly dim the skies over parts of the western U.S. and Central and South America. As the moon lines up precisely between Earth and the sun, It will blot out all but the sun's outer rim. A bright, blazing border will appear around the moon for as much as 5 minutes, wowing skygazers along a narrow path stretching from Oregon to Brazil. The celestial showstopper will yield a partial eclipse across the rest of the Western Hemisphere. It's a prelude to the total solar eclipse that will sweep across Mexico, the eastern half of the U.S., and Canada in 6 months. Unlike Saturday, when the moon is too far from Earth to completely cover the sun from our perspective, the moon will be at the perfect distance on April 8, 2024.